Thanks, Greg. I appreciate the chance to be here today. I think the diversity of this symposium, this morning session, really is what it reflects on how complex stormwater management actually is. So now you get to see some pretty pictures from me, as opposed to very dense research tables. But I think the whole context of stormwater certainly includes this green layer on the top as well. So as an overview, sustainability context for plants. I want to talk about sustainability as an umbrella because I think that's important for all of us. And then the plant context we'll put into green infrastructure. I'm going to include some basic design principles. It's absolutely key that the public accepts what these things look like that we design, not only functional health but aesthetics, so we'll talk about that. There's no brain surgery in here for sure, but as simplistic as some of the things will be that I mentioned, we often see bioretention, green infrastructure design that fails for a variety of reasons. I think sometimes it's the most simple things that need to be turned around. I'll throw out a couple of case studies, and then we'll see if we have some time for questions here. So again, the sustainability context, the triple bottom line of sustainability is environmental, social, and economic. We've talked a lot about environmental and economic already this morning, but the social piece that relates to acceptance, I think, is really important as well. So I'll spend a little bit more time with that. I have a favorite quote here. Whoops. Sorry about that. Look deep into nature, and then you'll understand everything better. Albert Einstein, of all people, said that. So I think one of the first things to start with is just the connection in the context of what we can learn from nature as we try to design and implement these functioning systems, especially over time. Some of you may have heard of biomimicry. It's an approach to innovation that seeks sustainable solutions to human challenges by emulating nature's time-tested patterns and strategies. Again, it sounds like a really simplistic context, but I think it's important. And as a quote on that, you could look at nature as being like a catalog of products, and all of those have benefited from a 3.8 billion year research and development period. And given that level of investment, it makes sense to use it. So as much as we engineer, as much as we have science that in the context of everything we're doing with stormwater management, I think just to stop back sometimes and understand how nature manages stormwater might give us some clues and some cues as to what we might want to try as well. And I'm a licensed landscape architect, so I am a full promoted tenured faculty member, but have that piece of practice. I'm about as left brain a landscape architect as you can get. So I always have to make sure it works, and then I go back and see if it looks good. So I think in another life I would have really been a good civil engineer. So I much more relate to civil engineering than architecture as part of the professional expertise. I had 8 to 10 years as a landscape architect. I was a landscape contractor. So the context of these things working is really, really important. And again, in looking at just the simplicity of sustainable design in general, you go down through this list. Combinations of plants and communities, which is how nature plants. Diversity is important. We want fast growth and slow growth. Everybody wants the fast-growing tree outside the front of the yard and at the house. That's the tree that falls over on your house after 50 years because the weak wood because of the fast growth. Even in a prairie, we have plant layering. You go out in the tall grass prairie, we've got 8-foot-tall big blue stem. There are plants down at the bottom in a full-sun prairie that still have to adapt to shade and sun. If we can emulate that in these bioretention cells and gardens that we design, those are things that are going to help with some of the success rates. Landscapes are never completed. Even whether it's the iron filings, whether it's the adsorption of phosphorus, there are things that we do in these cells that over time are going to have to obviously be maintained. And literally, I can see having to take out some of the underlying layers of some of these gardens as opposed to, in essence, fulfilling their processing in terms of chemicals and other things. Nature tends to be subtle. Nature mulches everything. And then the right plant in the right place is key, too. So as simplistic as it sounds, you see, I think, a lot of bioretention and green infrastructure design that may not actually correlate to that. Native is a huge consideration for plantings. That's kind of the first place we start in terms of deep-rooted, well-adapted plants. But we actually came up with an acronym in Omaha. I worked on the City of Omaha Environmental Element with others. The acronym is NEWANIP, so I have my one acronym I guess I'll throw out today, which stands for Native and Ecologically Well-Adapted Non-Invasive Plants. So as much as we aspire, I think, to use native plants because of all the benefits, the context of where are they native, how do they work, I think there is a role here. We've got to make sure that these cells and green infrastructure actually do work. The context then is even when we think we've figured out how to design these systems well, nature is starting to throw us many, many curves, I think far beyond what we typically used to have to deal with. And one of the pieces in the Great Plains that I think is potentially of greater concern than other parts of the country, although I think everybody's catching up, is the idea of drought and just how significant, how widespread the changes are to weather. So you'll see in some of the slides that I talk about, and my colleague Andy Zotko from the city will follow me up, is that we're not only looking at the plant materials, but we're actually trying to condense the cross-section of what is engineered versus trying to get plants back into the native soil. Because we're finding that it sounds like we should have plenty of water there, at least in most cases, but I think the diversity, the craziness of our climate means that we may have what we might call a plant that will tolerate some moisture, but then it's got to stand 3 months with nothing as part of the Great Plains. So that really increases, I think, the challenge of the design of some of these systems so that they're successful over time. The intelligent care and vivid care are absolutely critical. So maybe there's nothing else you leave the room with today. I think this is really important. As we look at the design of rain gardens, of bioretention systems, of anything that basically brings in the fuzziness of nature, which again is adaptation, there's two things that I've found as a landscape architect and as a designer of some of these systems that are critical. So one is intelligent care. There's two ways to help the public and others accept what this paradigm shift looks like relative to stormwater management. And if we're going to have them with aesthetic and have that fuzziness, if you can help people understand that the system actually has some environmental benefit to it. So the idea, we put signage up, as I work a lot with the City of Omaha on stormwater. It's a CSO community. There's a lot of green infrastructure going in that is saving a lot of money in Omaha, but our ability to actually get the public to understand that there's environmental value in these gardens, whether it's habitat, biodiversity, whatever it happens to be, can make a big difference in terms of the acceptance of some of these paradigm shifts. Oops. And then the other concept is vivid care. So if these features look like humans had some involvement with the design of them, that tends to help people understand and accept that whatever they're going to look like. And so massing of plants, you'll see in the upper right here, there's probably about six different plants in this particular garden in Omaha. Nature typically still masses. It's not quite as obvious as this in the picture, but it looks like somebody had something to do with this garden. I have rarely ever seen or spec'd bioretention where you just do a seed mix, for example. It's a tough call to be able to figure out what's a weed and what's not, and as diverse as nature can be oftentimes, just the simple massing. It's not to say these plants aren't going to move around over time as well. In fact, it's one of the interesting things to watch over time. This bottom picture shows this edge mode. I used to do a lot of workshops for the Golf Course Superintendents Association across the country. And every golf course superintendent would say you have to do this along the cart paths, where everybody would ask why you forgot to mow, even out on an Audubon golf course. So to have edges to what we do and to have massing, it sounds really simplistic, but if we're going to expand the palette of plants that we use for more function and aesthetic in these different systems, it's really important to consider those things. Sorry. Need to try to get back here. So it's going backwards. There we go. Sorry. We often use the term green infrastructure as kind of an umbrella to talk about all the things that we're looking at today that are designed. As a landscape architect, I like to take a step back. And I won't read this definition to you, but the context of it is that we don't screw things up in the first place. So if we can use nature, ecosystem services, there's a lot of terminology out there nowadays, that if we can understand what services nature provides us, if we have a beautiful bur oak and we know we don't get wet after a while in a rainstorm, nature is providing us a lot of stormwater management at times that we have typically gotten rid of to decide how we're going to manage the stormwater. So if we can just be a little bit more sensitive to that what I would call the green infrastructure up front, and then as we add our design features, I think things tend to work a little better. Philadelphia, I think, is still the only city in the country that's actually going all green with their infrastructure. They were faced with about a $6.8 billion cost for gray and green as part of managing their CSO. They said, we can't afford it. And I think at last count, their green system is about $1.8 to $2 billion. That's what they can afford. So it'll be interesting to see over time how that system pans out. But the idea that we can actually hang our hats on a system that's totally green, based in part on what some of the other discussion has been this morning, where we're really looking at more, we're going to implement these BMPs and that's worth this much in terms of both water quality and quantity, is an important consideration. Philadelphia is also a CSO. I think one of the things today, too, is that in Omaha as a CSO, our stipulation to EPA is water quality and quantity. Quantity is really reigns supreme, though, in terms of the overflows. So a lot of the stipulations that I look at today and talk about correlate to hanging on to water as opposed to having to filter water. That makes a huge difference in the design of some of these features. So just throwing out a couple of design elements. And context, again, this is not complicated. These are the four, these dominant elements are the four things that any designer uses. There's no reason we can't use them as much in a bioretention system, such as down here on the lower right, out in front of the Welcome Center on the university campus that I teach on. It's not complicated, but the idea of saying we have a list of plants and we're going to throw them out, and wherever they land, we're going to plant them, I think we're short shrift to really be able to get the benefits. If a plant likes to be a little bit wetter, we should put it in the bottom of the garden, a little bit drier towards the edge of the garden. And again, I mentioned the order, the context of defined bedlines, massing plants. Appropriate plant heights, I think, is also an absolute key consideration. This is the garden, again, on the UNO campus. There are people that get real nervous when that little blue stem in the foreground starts leaning like it is, even though as a native grass that has a lot of habitat value. So there's a push and pull on a lot of these plants, but the context of having that not manicured look for sure, but certainly the mass look I think is really, really important. And if you look at these two gardens, the one on the upper left is down in Kansas City. The one on the lower right is at a church. This one down here is at a church. Joe Pye weed at 8 feet tall in a garden that's 8 foot by 8 foot is just completely out of scale. And as soon as it starts leaning, it looks weedy. And as soon as one of these systems looks weedy, then it's time for people to want to replace it. The one on the upper left, again, is not dense enough. There's a lot of erosion there. It doesn't have nice defined edges. There was no mulch used. And those are gardens that are not well accepted by the public. And if we're going to have a lot of these on public property and out in the open in public landscapes, we're going to have an expectation for a little bit better management. It doesn't have to be expensive management, but it's management nevertheless. Just to repeat things, it's one of the most basic design principles. Could be color. The gay feather there on the left, two different species of gay feather. The flower color is similar. There's some the tops of this Indian grass across the top repeats. And then even just to have the form of a garden, this is actually a rectilinear garden out in front of an engineering office in Kansas City. But there's simple kinds of things that can help correlate to this public acceptance. And again, if we're going to use this across the board in a lot of urban landscapes, it's important to have that acceptance. This is repetition of asters. These are still blooming like this in Omaha. We've had a wonderful fall, one of the best I can remember in a long time. But just the idea of repeating plants, the fewer plants you have, the fewer they're going to want specific treatments and different maintenance considerations. So part of the simplicity of these gardens and the manageability is actually to use fewer kinds of plants and use more of them. I've been accused of never being affordable in the real world. I tend to go crazy. I have the luxury at school of being able to do planting designs such as this one. But I think as part of a resource and research, just to understand how plants work in a garden, this is the one out in front of our Welcome Center I'll talk about here in just a second. It's rare in the real world to have the time to manage, not manage, but to have the luxury to actually design like this. But we're learning a lot as part of trying these different plants out. And just again, this is a colored plan view diagram of this garden. There's a lot going on here, but just in terms of these colored bubbles as I go through here, there's a lot of repetition in this garden. And some of it correlates to being out of the water, in the water. I'll show you the cells here in just a second. Some of this relates to shrubs. Some of this relates to asters. Some of it's goldenrods. There's plants out here that are one of a kind, like a native button bush, that are important in terms of accenting a certain part of the garden. But, again, in a diagram like this, it's not that it's not that difficult, and yet there, I think there are some things that really help out with the aesthetics. We're doing a lot with sedges in Omaha and in the Midwest. I think sedges may be one of the plants that are really critical for these gardens in the future. They tend to be very adaptable to wet and dry. A lot of them are adaptable to full sun. So I think we've got 8 different species in this particular garden. We've probably experimented with about 15 different species in the Omaha area as part of these gardens that are, again, are going to have to be low maintenance over time. This is the garden. The view on the right shows what this looked like prior to this garden going in. It was basically a cattail swamp. This is the front door of the campus. The diagram on the left actually shows the 2 watersheds that this garden runs into. So basically the north side of the building is one watershed, and then the west side of the building is the second watershed. This is what the finished garden looked like when it was initially put in. This was all grant funded through the state and the city. It's made a huge difference in terms of the front of the Welcome Center, but also for teaching resources and for a place for folks to be on campus. So you can see the 2 cells outlined in blue there. The water runs through this garden. It has a place to exit. Diagram on the bottom is a little bit small. One of these cells does have the upturned elbow in it, as was described earlier, just based on hitting some elevations prior to what was used for that initial garden. So again, and we hesitate to call these gardens across the city, because a garden means it's going to be a lot of money and a lot of maintenance. But these initial ones that were really supposed to be designed to demonstrate to the public what's possible, where we put in very highly visible areas and put signage up, I think have been critical to try to get that paradigm shift made for the public. When our sewer rates are going to go up 3 times in Omaha, people don't like that. But when you tell them raw sewage is floating down the Missouri River, if we don't do something, they don't like that either. So that's that social piece where you get a lot of pushback, obviously, in terms of what ultimately has to happen. This was the garden last summer, a lot of native plants. I think the picture kind of speaks for itself. And this was just this last fall. There's a lot of sedge here in the foreground. We've got broom sedge, we've got palm sedge, the asters, the goldenrod. And then we've also got, this is a Missouri primrose right over here, very drought-tolerant plant, tend to plant it literally at the edge of where the water's supposed to be. Well, guess who is now reseeding itself in the bottom of the cells where all the water collects? So the context, just when you think you've got the plants figured out, so it'll be an interesting process to follow these plants in the garden. If they want to grow in the bottom of the cell as well as on the edge, I'm all for it. That may be the most adaptable plant we have out there. But we don't know that till we actually follow some of these plants around and see what they want to do. And then again, the habitat value, absolutely critical, whether it's the concern for the monarch butterfly. It's when you go out there and see a crust of insects this time of year, you kind of wonder where they'd all be otherwise. And then again, it's another attribute, it's another benefit of these gardens that I think if the plants are selected properly, that just it's one more thing we can hang our hats on to say green infrastructure actually does pay back well. This is another garden just to throw out. This is a sewer maintenance facility for the city. You'll notice some really interesting parties involved with this. We actually had the Office of Research and Development from EPA out of their Cincinnati headquarters. Region 7 EPA out of Kansas City. We had the U.S. Geological Survey, the City of Omaha, a couple of engineering firms, and then previously as an extension specialist, I was working on this. So the whole premise on this, if you look at the cell here at the bottom, was virtually all grasses, sedges, and rushes as plants, which all have that grass-like texture. I think oftentimes as we go crazy with coneflowers and goldenrods, once they bloom, they look like weeds. And so again, if we're going to use these large scale, mow them once a year, and have some diversity with the different grass textured plants, maybe our future is to have more of a city focus on using that palette of plants, given the lower maintenance considerations, but also the fact that the public may be more willing to accept that prairie type look as opposed to a lot of the other the flowers that end up looking weedy, even though there's habitat value to those obviously as well. This is another garden at the east end of Benson, small community within the city of Omaha. This drains about 4 acres of hardscape. This was a street that had to be closed as part of an intersection redo. This was some of the initial planting the first fall, and this was just this last summer. So it's also amazing how well these gardens will fill in and do, even just in a short amount of a year or two, if everything is selected properly and the right plants are in the right places in these gardens to fill in as perennial plants. One other consideration, this is a purple poppy mallow right here in the foreground. There are areas of these gardens that have nothing to do with where the water sits. So the context of these gardens to look well in landscape means that we've got drought-tolerant plants that will never be in water. It isn't just the ring that we need to talk about. There is a context to these areas that's also very important. And then just to wrap up, I've been working with an OPS faculty member, Omaha Public Schools, as part of doing some research in some of the gardens that have been designed with the city. We tend to not go back and actually see how things are doing. So we've taken some soil borings, we've done some chemical testing, and this high school teacher then is also taking this back into her high school classroom to talk about the scientific method. STEM and STEAM, if any of you heard of those acronyms, are huge. There's nothing better than a rain garden to cover every aspect of STEM and STEAM that there is in terms of curriculum for students. So this piece, again, it gets back to that social piece. If we can get that underlying acknowledgement and awareness of stormwater at a younger age, I think that helps all of us, because it's going to cost all of us a lot of money to be able to implement what we're talking about here today, regardless of how much expertise we have. It's an important piece to make sure we don't have rivers catching on fire again anytime in the near future. Yep.
Great talk, thank you. As a regulator, we deal with people who, I'm not going to say they don't care about this stuff, but they just want to get the regulator off their back. But we're aware of this stuff too. We realize the benefits of ecosystem services. So how, do you have any suggestions for how arborists and landscape architects and people like that can connect with the regulated community and try to get these practices?
I think a lot of times it's the combination of the carrot and the stick. I think the incentives, I'll say for myself, I've done a lot of extension work with the green industry in the state, and frankly have been frustrated a lot of times in terms of the lack of folks who could be, I think, more related to green infrastructure as literally as a profit line in their company. And you do get the pushback of what we've done in the past worked, why do we have to change our paradigm right now? We've never had to do a landscape that actually functioned. It just had to look good. So it's a tough call. I continue to think that we need to start lower on the age in terms of the awareness of a lot of this stuff. There's a lot of folks that, as you said, just say I don't want to deal with it. Just give me the bottom line. I've had engineers and workshops that I've taught say don't tell me. Just tell me the five plants that are guaranteed to work. And again, sometimes that's all it counts based on the amount of cost effectiveness. I think the better we can get all of the other services into the equation of the benefits that pay back, I think the better we're all going to be. But I don't have an answer to say how can we get everybody on board, because we all fight that. Especially if it's a federal, if it's a government mandate telling us what to do. There's a lot of folks that are immediately in defensive mode regardless of the benefits, just because somebody has told them what to do from on high. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm part of the stormwater management team from Montgomery County Parks. We have 35,000 acres, and we're going more and more to smaller stormwater facilities like this, so doing multiple small types of facilities instead of really one large one. We really struggle with, especially with this getting established, with noxious and invasive weeds. And I am just wondering, for you, in your experience, do you engage students or volunteer groups, especially, you know, I can see a lot of blank areas, that's our problem when they're establishing that weed management is really, really important.
For the lot of experience I've had, again, in terms of putting these demonstration gardens together for the future, the city of Omaha has actually hired folks to go out and literally do what you were just talking about in terms of keeping the weeds down. If you're going to use mulch, that obviously helps. There's issues of floating mulch at times if it's not an offline garden. I use master gardeners a lot because no matter how many times people say they want to volunteer to do something, you still need somebody to make sure the volunteers actually do volunteer. So all the questions everybody's asking is a critical, and it's complex, and I'm not sure what the answers are just yet, other than we need to keep chipping away at them.
Thank you.